Today, as you can tell, this area is kind of empty. He's having fun in Washington or Seattle. Sermon series about worship. We talked about where worship, times and places, you know, basically what is worship altogether. You know, when I was, you know, this is one of those things that, again, I was, you know, I was doing sound booth for somebody, and Tiffany and the worship team was planning this stuff, and she started shooting me off more ideas about, you know, when do you want to preach, and I said, I want to preach on this one. So, you know, she already knew that, though, but she always, you know, she knows me really well. But again, this idea of what it is that we worship, that's what we're going to be talking about today. And I kind of, you know, the song that we just sang, From the Inside Out, this bridge, the last part of the bridge, it says, and the cry of my heart is to bring you praise. From the inside out, Lord, my soul cries out. So this idea of what is worship should be something where our souls cry out to God. This idea that the things that we do and the actions that we take and the lives that we live should glorify and honor God. Then I start thinking about, you know, I write down, when I do these kinds of things, I like to write down lots of questions, lots and lots of questions about myself. And some of the questions I had was like, do my actions glorify God? Do my thoughts glorify God? Does the time that I spend here on earth, does that glorify God? Does the money that I spend glorify God? Do the relationships that I have with people glorify God? Because ultimately, everything that is us, while we're here on earth, should glorify our Savior, Lord Jesus Christ. See, back in the Old Testament times, there was God and there was God's people, but then there's also other sets of people, and they had these things called idols. And when they had idols, they were usually statues or figurines, and they would, you know, have an idol for like the god of the rain. And so then they would go and, you know, give things or try to atone or try to please that god, so that way rain would fall down from the sky. And then they would have a god for, you know, the seed and the plants on the ground. And so that way, okay, so we got this god happy. Let's do this god down here to make sure that the plants kind of raise up out of the ground. Then they would have like an altar. And that's where they would bring things to this altar. And they would come and they would worship these statues or figurines, trying to appease these gods of sorts. Now thinking about like today's culture, let's rewind, let's fast forward a little bit to today's culture, today's time. And I often think about, you know, we really don't have like places. You know, there are beliefs, you know, they're like Buddhism and then Hinduism that have these statues and idols, but let's take all that aside. Let's take our own lives here today. And I think of what's a place out there in the world that we set space and time that we kind of create maybe these altars. Did we have an idea? Could be virtual. Movies are a good one. What was that over here? Video games, TV, that's another good place. I think we're getting really close. Disneyland. Oh, Disneyland's terrible, isn't it? That place is full of idols. That's right. That's right. Sometimes. But I'm thinking more something that's more like self-worship. And I kind of think there's this idea of like social media. Everybody has one of those things right nowadays. You know, like a Facebook page. I know. Yeah, Nikki's giving me the knock it off sign right now. She's giving me it. We have Facebook, we have Instagram. And what are these things? What are these places that we put? Now, I'm going to preface this by saying these things aren't entirely evil. They can be used for good. But then we're talking about this idea of what we worship. A lot of times these things have a picture of ourselves on it, right? You know, so we have this picture of ourselves. I'm looking at Nikki right here. She's right? That's right. You know, so we kind of create maybe this mini altar, right? We put our cover picture of, you know, I don't know, unicorns or whatever. I don't know. You know, we put things about ourselves in these areas. And then we hope that people look at these things on our Facebook pages And we put like, you know, we've all done this, right? You know, we put like a cryptic status update, you know what I mean? Like, today's going terrible. And then everybody's like, well, why is it going terrible, Jesse? You know what I mean? So, but again, that's just one little thing, one little thing. I'm not saying that Facebook's bad or social media is bad because it's great when it works and when it's beautiful when it all comes together and works correctly. But in John chapter 12, verses 25 through 26, you don't have to turn to this for right now, but it says, those who love their life in this world will lose it. Those who care nothing for their life in this world will keep it for eternity. Anyone who wants to be my disciple must follow me, because my servants must be where I am, and the Father will honor anyone who serves me. So again, we start going along this little path that we're going to go along today, and I start thinking of things. What are the things in this world that I love? What are those physical things that I, you know, sometimes you can have like mementos or things like that, trinkets. But even more so, what are the thoughts that we elevate above Jesus? I read this article today, this week, and they use this word. What are the things that we elevate above creation? You know, God created everything. What are the things that we elevate above God's creation, God's glory? Because, you know, for most folks, when they think of church and think of worship, they think about what we just did. It's more than just singing. I can tell you that right now. It's more than just showing up and listening to myself, Dave, or Stephen, or whoever it is that gets up here and talks for 20 to an hour or whatever. And it's more than the ministries that we do here, and it's more than our jobs. It's more than everything. Because being a true worshiper in Jesus Christ requires being a servant. Now, in Paul's letters to, you know, the Galatians and the Philippians and then to letters in Corinth, he often refers himself to as a what? Anybody? What? What was that in the back? Servant, okay. So he uses sometimes even a more harsher word than servant, bondslave. Slave, yeah, there we go. And we could be slaves to all kinds of things, right? You know, we live in a super fast-paced world. Because I work in this world, you know, in this fast-paced culture. Because I got people who want, like, all this stuff over here, and it's like, man, you're just kind of filling your life with a bunch of junk. You know what I mean? But they pay me to do it, so I won't complain too much. But there's a lot of things that battle for our attention, both externally and internally. The things that are physical and the things that are thoughts in our mind. And there's things in our lives that can creep up out of all that. You know, there's could be those ungodly thoughts and ungodly behaviors that when times get tough, we tend to fall back on. You know. And of course, like, see, I remember Stephen saying this, we're really good at legitimizing things, right? You know what I mean? When somebody does something bad to us, or if somebody says something, or, you know, an action gets, you know, put upon us, then we're really good at justifying the things in our life that cause us to stumble. We're really good at that kind of stuff. So again, what are the things that we elevate above Jesus? What are those habits in our lives that can cause us to not have a fulfilled relationship with Jesus? We're gonna go back, because again, these people just keep on giving, which is great. We're gonna go to Exodus chapter 24. You can go ahead and turn to your Bibles there. Exodus chapter 24. So up until this point, the Israelites have been out of Egypt for just about 2 months. All right? So they've seen God do, like, miraculous things. Like, things that are, like, biblical proportions, so to speak. All right? So, you know, first off, God put upon Pharaoh's heart to let them out of Egypt. Okay, so they're no longer captives in Egypt anymore. And then they get to the point where, you know, God parts the Red Sea. And then they walk through this body of water on dry ground, basically. Alright? So they've seen that. He's provided for these people over and over again. So in chapter 24, they stop at this place called Mount Sinai. So again, it usually helps for my brain to have like visuals and things like that. So I can imagine, you know, a little mountain. No, this is a gigantic mountain. This mountain's like almost 8,000 feet tall. So if you've never been to a mountain that's 8,000 feet tall, they are really tall and they are really hard to walk up. And there's usually no oxygen once you get up to, well, there's oxygen, but not very much oxygen once you get up to the top of that. So this is a gigantic mound of dirt and rock, basically. Prior to chapter 24, God gives Moses the Ten Commandments, proper ways of worship, how to treat people. Again, Moses gets schooled by God during these times. And let's go ahead and read, I'm going to go ahead and read Exodus chapter 24, verses 12 through 17 here. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain, stay there, and I will give you the tablets of stone on which I have inscribed the instructions and commands so you can teach the people." So Moses and his assistant Joshua set out, and Moses climbed up the mountain. Moses told the elders, "Stay here and wait until we come back. Aaron and Hur are with you here, are here with you. If anyone has a dispute while I'm gone, consult with them." Okay? So God calls Moses up. He tells Joshua to go with them. Who's in charge here? None other than Aaron, than Moses' brother Aaron. And this guy named Hur, which apparently I did some research, and this is like the only time he's really mentioned. So apparently he was not a very good leader. So we'll continue on here. Verse 15, "Then Moses climbed up the mountain, and the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled down on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, the Lord called Moses from inside the cloud to the Israelites, to the Israelites at the foot of the mountain. The glory of the Lord appeared at the summit like a consuming fire. Then Moses disappeared into the cloud as he climbed higher up the mountain. He remained on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights." The Israelites are in great hands, right? God calls Moses. You know, this is like a, you know, this should not be a not out of the ordinary type thing. This idea of God calling Moses out and giving him instructions. So this should be a semi-regular thing that's happening on an occasion, on such occasions. Who does he leave in charge? His brother Aaron. Again, great hands. Aaron went with Moses to Pharaoh to plead for the release of the Israelites. And Moses is going to be getting some instructions, ways of worship, proper worship, some more schooling, so to speak. Laws that, if they followed, would produce pure worship. So part of what I, when I do these studies and things like that, I like to put myself in the Israelite shoes a little bit. It's kind of neat for us because we get a little bit of hindsight. We know that that Moses was gone for 40 days and 40 nights. It says at the end of chapter 24. But God didn't exactly tell, hey, you know, the Israelites that he was going to be gone for that long, right? He just kind of said, God just said, "Moses, come on up." And Moses was like, "All right, Aaron and Hur, you're in charge, and I don't know when I'll be back. I'll just, you know, I might show up, you know, tomorrow, next week." So I have this kind of thing planned out here. Week one, all right? So we can think of week one. I could hear the Israelites just saying, "It's okay, Moses will be back. He will return. It won't be that long. He can't be gone longer than a week, right?" The week number two passes by. He's been up there a while. I wonder what he's doing. And then week three, I could just see all these people starting to get really nervous. He was supposed to be our leader. Where did he go? Week number four, doubt starts to set in. Insecurities start coming back. Old ways of thinking start coming back. And by week five, as we're going to read here, it's like complete chaos. So in 40 short days, we got a people who are committed to God to a people who have lost their way. Let's go ahead and turn to Exodus chapter 32. We'll see what happens. 32 verses 1 through 6. Wait, let's see here. Right, okay. Notes are correct. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and read Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 through 6. Again, Moses has been up on the mountain for up to at least 40 days at this point, maybe a little less. When the people saw how long it was taking Moses to come back down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron. So again, this isn't a small group of people. This is like a gigantic group of people too. All right? There's a lot of people here. And they said, come on, they said, make us some gods who can lead us. We don't know what happened to this fellow Moses who brought us here from the land of Egypt. And I like how they kind of like, this fellow Moses, like he's just some dude, you know. He wasn't anything special. He was just this guy named Moses that, you know, brought us into death into this wilderness. Verse number 2. So Aaron said, take the gold rings from the ears of your wives and sons and daughters and bring them to me. All the people took the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. Then Aaron took the gold, melted it down, and molded it into a shape of a calf. When the people saw it, they exclaimed, O Israel, these are the gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Aaron saw how excited the people were, so he built an altar in front of the calf. Then he announced, tomorrow will be the festival to the Lord. So the people got up early the next morning to sacrifice burnt offerings and peace offerings. After this, they celebrated with feasting and drinking, and they indulged in pagan revelry. Aaron was supposed to be in charge of this group of people. He should have known better. Again, he went face to face with Pharaoh. How quickly they swayed from the ways of God to the ways that they used to go to. Now, I read that. Do you think God was really happy with their actions? Huh? I don't think so. He was not very happy at all. In verse 9, we see that God has fierce anger towards the Israelites. God was ready to be done with these people. This is, as you know, I preached the last time about the Israelites going into the promised land, and God wasn't really happy with them there when, you know, they were afraid. So this is seems to be a cycle with them. They do things that don't please God, and then God doesn't exactly like it. But Moses convinces God that, remember, these were your people. You rescued them out of Egypt, and what would the Egyptians say if you were to do this? So again, what does God do? He tells Moses to race down the mountain, and he has two stone tablets with him. So he walks down the mountain is really what it says. And again, I'm thinking, again, when I picture Moses walking down the mountain with these stone tablets at this 8,000 foot mountain, you know, I don't know, has anybody ever walked down a mountain without a trail before? Because I'm, you know, yeah. We call that bushwhacking, all right? Why? Because you're whacking bushes as you're going up or down the trail. So who are you? We got this guy, Moses, with these tablets, with probably not very proper hiking equipment, like boots, getting down to save his people. Now let's go ahead and read it. Again, I could not write this any better. You know, it's just amazing how this ends up working out. Let's read verse 19 through 24. We're going to read Aaron's response to this whole thing, to what's going on. All right, verse 19. When they came near the camp, Moses saw the calf and the dancing, and he burned with anger. He threw the stone tablets to the ground, smashing them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf and they had made and burnt it. Then he ground it into powder
threw it into water, and forced the people to drink it. Yikes. That's a punishment right there. You know what I mean? We don't know what, you know, sure it was gold, but you don't know what else it was made out of. Verse 21. I did a little studying and reading up on this. This is like the excuses of Aaron is really what I call this. Finally, he turned to Aaron and demanded, what did these people do to make you bring such terrible sin upon them? This is Aaron's response. Don't get upset, my Lord, and replied, you know yourself how evil these people are. So right away, we all know what throwing somebody under the bus is, right? Right? We all know. We may have done that once or twice in our life, right? You know how evil these people are, Lord. You left me in charge with crazy people. You know you were going to do that. It's not my fault. It's all them over there. And then Aaron said in verse 23, they said to me, make us gods that will lead us. We don't know what happened to this fellow Moses who brought us here from the land of Egypt. So again, I throw people under the bus, and then I succumb to peer pressure. And then verse 24, so I told them, whoever has gold jewelry, take it off. So this idea that I just ended up giving up and just doing whatever the group wanted to do. And this is my favorite part. Again, I read this and I just about fell on the floor because, again, he's really grabbing for some legitimacy to the mistakes that he made. And this is great. The second half of verse 24 says, whoever has gold jewelry, take it off. When they brought it to me, I simply threw it into the fire, and it came out this calf. Wait a second. So you're telling me it was a miracle? It was a miracle. How can Moses? I'm thinking, for he went to the straight up crazy extreme on this one here. All right. I just took the gold, Moses. I just threw it into the fire, and then poof, there was this preformed calf that came out. That's legitimacy right there. You know, God wasn't exactly done with them at this point. You know, there was a punishment. Some people had to die, which is fine. But ultimately, Aaron and the people he was left in charge with grew fearful. Their insecurities got the best of them. They had started this path of becoming renewed in God and as God's chosen people. But when times got tough, they reverted back to old patterns. Let's go ahead and turn to Romans chapter 12. In fact, I think we're going to be in Romans for the rest of it. No. Romans chapter 12. So the Israelites struggled with a legitimate idol. This idea of there was a legitimate figurine, a physical idol that they were worshiping. They needed to be renewed. Again, I go back to those questions I asked. What are the things in my life that I might be blind to that I'm unwillingly or unknowingly worshiping or elevating above God? The nice thing is the Bible has answers. Let's go ahead and read Romans chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And so, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. Do not copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, which is good, pleasing, and perfect. This is an everyday thing. This idea of renewing our mind, not conforming to ways of the world. Our lives are supposed to look different as Christ followers. We're supposed to say things differently. Facebook statuses should look differently. Instagram pictures should look differently. What decals we put in our cars should look differently. The way we drive should look differently. I don't know why I'm pointing at you, Tiffany. But everything should be put in this filter of Jesus and what he's done for us. We should be able to find examples of what a good Christ follower looks like. Kind of what I like to do in my professional life, and I kind of do with my spiritual life too. And I'll take my business life for one. You know, I own a small business, super small, just me. But I like watching and reading about people who have been successful in their business. Alright? So I like to see what they've done. I like to look at and read about the mistakes that they made so that way I can apply it to my life. And the same thing goes to my spiritual life. I find people, whether you know it or not, I find people whose traits are most Christ-like, and I try to mimic that. I don't do it just for one person, it's a lot of people, because one person isn't good, you know, might be good at that, and another person might be good at that. But ultimately it comes down to what God and Jesus, his word says I should look like. Again, similar to how our lives should be a witness for everybody to see, it's the same thing for myself. I'm looking out there just as much as you're looking out here for what a good and proper spiritual life should look like. Again, these things shouldn't automatically come from like newsstands. You know, every time I go to Raley's, I always like, man, you know, people actually, you know, if you do buy these magazines, that's okay, you know. But I can't find value in something like that, or some of the things that we watch on TV. And again, not all of it is bad, but we have to keep it in perspective and keep it in balance. Does it distract us from God and what his will and what the relationship he wants? Or does it bring us closer to him? Part of that verse 12 in Romans talks about if we let God transform our lives, then we can find purpose. We could find God's will. We can do the things that are pleasing and perfect to God. Because ultimately, that's what my life should look like, shouldn't it? I shouldn't be asking or looking for acceptance in my peers or, you know, or the people that I work for. I need to know what God's will is for my life. Not necessarily what other people's will is for my life. Let's go ahead and turn to one more passage here, Hebrews chapter 4. Again, part of this idea of what we worship, a lot of times we could race after it. You know, we could be staking our whole entire lives to get to the next level or to the next goal or get the next thing. And I've been guilty of that. You know? But as I learn what God's will is for my life, I hope and pray that it can mimic Jesus Christ. And then there's this idea, because when you're racing constantly, you forget to rest. This really deep rest. Just take a few seconds here. What does deep rest look for you?
What can it look for you? Is it sitting on the beach? Now, that's one of my wives. She loves that. She doesn't like my rest, which is, you know, being out in the middle of nowhere in the forest and just kind of look. Yeah, you got to hike. But that is proper rest, though. Being on top of a mountain, that's where I find my rest, though. So think of the places in your life where it's like, I could be here forever. I have a semi-funny story. I have bouts of, I'm a lot better at it now, of anxiety, especially when I go to the doctor, which, you know, nobody ever likes going to the doctor or the dentist. You know what I mean? I love going to my chiropractor, though. That's a place I find rest. But this idea of rest, I went to the doctor and, you know, they always check my blood pressure. And every time I go do those machines where you press the button, it always says that I'm about to die. You know what I mean? It's like your blood pressure is really high. Go see a doctor. I'm like, I don't got high blood pressure. Those things don't mean anything. Kristen and Tiffany's looking at me kind of funny over here. So I go to just get a checkup and I put it down and I'm like really like, oh, it's going to say high. It's going to say I need to take a pill now or whatever like that. And she's like, whoa. That's really high. I was like, I know. She's like, just relax. So, yeah, so what do? I sit in the chair, I take a deep breath, and I just start praying. And she takes my measure, she does it again, and she's like, whoa, I want to go where you went. But I didn't tell her what I told Tiffany later. It might sound a little cheesy, but it's the truth. I said, you know, I put myself in a place where I was sitting on the beach in like this horseshoe shaped area and it was me and Jesus sitting right next to each other. The rest made my blood pressure drop to a very normal level. Again, this idea of rest is where the insecurities and the worries and the internal thoughts that we battle with on a daily basis and the external habits that we've gotten ourselves into disappear. Where we elevate God's perfect purpose higher than our selfishness. Where our worldview could be changed and filtered through Jesus. God has something better for us. It's rest. And let's go ahead and read. I got to get there first. Hebrews chapter 4. Which if you haven't read Hebrews, it's a great book to read just to start. If you find a place that you're like, I don't know what to read, Lord. I started reading Hebrews, and man, I started marking this thing up all over the place. But that was just God speaking to me. But like I said, this is a great, these passages talk about God's rest. So Hebrews chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. Wait. Oh, yes, that's correct. God's promise of entering his rest still stands, so we ought to tremble with fear that some of you might fail to experience it. For the good news that God has prepared this rest has been announced to us just as it was them. He's talking about the Israelites here. It's like almost talking about the same story back in Exodus. But it did them no good because they didn't share the faith of those who listen to God. For only we who believe can enter his rest. So again, we have to believe to enter his rest. As it continues here, as for the others, God said, in my anger, I took an oath. They will never enter my place of rest. Even though this rest has been ready since he made the world, we know it is ready because of the place in scriptures where it mentions the seventh day. On the seventh day, God rested from work. But in the other passages, God said, they will never enter my place of rest. So God's rest
is there for people to enter, but those who first heard the good news failed to enter it because they disobeyed God. And this is the important part. God set another time for entering his rest, and that time is today. Again, what we worship does not mean just getting up here and talking or singing. It's about finding this rest. It's not about the times that we miss the mark. Again, what are the things that we elevate above Jesus? What does rest look like for you? It's deeper than just this room here. It has to be deeper than this room here. As we wrap up today, and the worship team can come on up, the whole idea of worship that we've been talking about here, it's not about a place or time or how many songs we sing or how long or short I preach. It needs to be how we glorify God with my whole life, and how can I improve his kingdom. And if we were to do all that, then we could find God's peace, his shalom, and his rest. Those are just byproducts of following his will. So I'm going to go and pray, and then the worship team is going to go and sing our last song. Heavenly Father, you created everything, Lord. This creation was meant and designed for you, Lord. And how we go about life and what we do with your creation actually means something, Lord. So, Lord, I pray that we take an honest look at our lives, Lord, and the things that we do and the thoughts that we have. And I pray that you would transform them into your ways, Lord. Because ultimately, your peace is what we want. Your rest is what we want. That is the true act of worship, Lord. So our lives can glorify you and impact your kingdom. Lord, I just pray this in your name. Amen.